Of Minnesota. You're listening to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson on your Thursday afternoon. So today's show is pre-recorded, but I am going to be playing back two interviews that I recently conducted, and some of the topics we're going to be talking about have nothing to do with the coronavirus / COVID-19, since I think it's not the worst thing in the world to take a break from that topic every once in a while. So coming up on the show today, we're going to be continuing my conversation with Aaron Klemz of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. Now, yesterday I played back just part of my interview I conducted with Aaron regarding this recent court ruling that went against PolyMet, but since yesterday was such a busy news cycle, I didn't have a chance to play back that entire conversation, so there was several key points that we weren't able to get to, so we'll play back that entire conversation with Aaron coming up a little bit later. Also, we are going to be speaking with our Capitol reporter from Minnesota lawyer Kevin Featherly about a couple of topics. Now, one is related to the coronavirus, as we're going to be talking about what the legislature could be talking about now that they are set to reconvene today. And then we'll be talking about a non-coronavirus-related topic about this immigration case that's made its way through a district court in Minnesota. It's an extremely complicated but very interesting case that shows just how complicated immigration is, where there is a lot of gray area. So we're going to play back that conversation with Kevin Featherly of Minnesota Lawyer coming up next on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. The progressive voice of Minnesota. It's FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Well, we're joined now by Kevin Featherly. He is the Capitol reporter for Min Lawyer, our usual Capitol insider, and also someone who covers a lot of legal cases working their way through the Minnesota courts, as he's going to update us on a couple of stories that he's been working on. Kevin, good to have you back on the show.
Nice to hear from you.
Yeah, so let's start off with this case that just happened in the 8th Circuit here in Minnesota, the U.S. 8th Circuit, because this has to do with a very complicated immigration case that's been working its way through the courts for a number of years. It has to do with a guy named Juan Javier Cruz Rodriguez, who owned a Perkins store in West St. Paul, but he was here illegally, and he's been in the country for years, I think close to two decades. And recently he was ordered to be deported after his appeal was denied by the 8th Circuit. So can you give us some details on this case? Because as we're going to go through, this is an extremely complicated and really heart-wrenching case as well.
Right. This guy's name, I think you're right that he was known as Juan Javier Rodriguez, but he's also, his real name apparently was Alvaro Cruz Rodriguez. I'm not familiar with him. I'd never dined in that restaurant. I did see a reference to a story about a Perkins in the South Metro closing where a Juan Rodriguez was quoted. But, you know, that's a very common name, so I can't be certain that they're one and the same guy. But at any rate, you're right. He was arrested in 2017, in 2017 that he was arrested for domestic violence. And the West St. Paul police reported that there were scratches and bruises on his common law wife, who's identified only as Rosa in this ruling. And the accusation made by the police is that he, you know, grabbed her on the throat, threw her down. He was arrested. He was charged with misdemeanor, two counts of misdemeanor domestic assault and one count of disorderly conduct. Well, he went through the early process of having been charged for those things. The court, what happened is he was arrested. He was let out on bail, and almost immediately, the immigration, well, ICE whatever that stands for, I've forgotten. Immigration, Customs.
I think it's Customs Enforcement, yeah.
Yeah, right, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They arrested him, and they hauled him off to a county jail in Sherburne County. And from there, things got a little hinky, I think. His lawyer certainly would put it that way. His lawyer, again, Jason Nielsen, petitioned, he says, four times for a writ of habeas corpus to get ICE to release this guy to the county custody so that he could face the domestic assault charges. According to Nielsen, he was never released. And so, you know, people were able to testify against him. He wasn't really able to fully defend himself against the charges. And nonetheless, he was only ultimately convicted of the lesser disorderly conduct charge. But in the process of that, an automatic restraining order was placed against Mr. Rodriguez. So his wife and he couldn't come in contact. Well, that came into play when there was a deportation order issued. That case went to the immigration law judge in Bloomington. They have court at Fort Snelling. And that judge, a fellow named Ryan Wood, heard the case, didn't like some of what he heard. He didn't like the allegations of domestic abuse. He was a little troubled by some indications that there were some irregularities in the business owner's tax returns, et cetera. But on balance, Judge Wood found that his moral character and, you know, the hardship that would be caused were he deported overrode the interest of having him deported as an illegal alien. You are right. He was not in the country legally. He'd been here since 1998, worked himself up from temp service jobs all the way to ownership in the restaurant industry. So Ryan Wood, Judge Wood found him, was willing to let him stay, but the Department of Homeland Security protested. The Bureau of Immigration Appeals, which is another level of court, retried his case. They found that all of the allegations amounted to a lack of moral good standing. And I think that was most of what they used to uphold the, you know, to reinstate the deportation order. And he was deported, and he is deported, leaving behind a family, including a mentally ill daughter, who, according to the attorney, Mr. Nielsen, told me that her mental illness is such that she hadn't left her home to go outside even during her teen years, other than the time that she went to testify on her father's behalf in the immigration court. Well, he's gone now, and he remains gone. And the Eighth Circuit looked at the case. They sided with the Bureau, the Board of Immigration Appeals, upheld his deportation. He will remain out of the country. They said essentially that they didn't consider some new evidence that emerged, you know, that the lawyer was able to get after the fact, you know, after, you know, the whole thing with ICE and all that stuff, the fact that he had a restraining order and his wife couldn't appear in court to testify on his behalf. He got an affidavit, tried to submit all this stuff. The Eighth Circuit ignored the new evidence, so that they only have to regard the evidence in the administrative record. And they said that they had no jurisdiction to override a decision by the Attorney General William Barr in the case, and that effectively Mr. Rodriguez had no substantiated rights to due process, and so he's gone.
Wow, and there is certainly a lot to unpack there. So let's back up and go to kind of where the genesis of this whole controversy started. And that's when he faced these allegations of domestic abuse. As soon as you said, he was released from bail, he was already taken into custody from ICE. And I think this is important to point out, because even though, as we were pointing out, he's certainly not, or at least doesn't appear to be, a squeaky clean individual, he didn't have an opportunity to go and defend himself against these allegations of domestic abuse. And as it sounds like, well, some of the results from this case was used against him in future hearings. Is that kind of what I'm gathering?
Well, to a degree. I mean, he did have an attorney. The attorney appeared on his behalf and argued his case and certainly was able to consult with him. But to the best of my knowledge, he wasn't able to appear in court himself. And, of course, that's an issue, you know, to be able to, you know, face your accusers. It's kind of nice to have your face in the room with your accusers. And he apparently wasn't given that opportunity. And the federal authorities at ICE essentially ignored, from what I gather, his requests and his writs of habeas corpus. And there was a statement by the DOJ's attorney, if I can find it quickly, where she, I'd have to search around for it here. She essentially just said that that's not really a constitutional colorable claim that ICE got in the way of that case.
Wait, Ace, and they were, she was really saying that? that just doesn't seem
to... I want to find the actual quote if I can. This is a quote, which is a little, it's directly out of the record from the oral argument, so it may be slightly convoluted, but here's the quote. The notion that this petitioner was in any way precluded from presenting his case or appearing in a criminal case, I submit, is not a colorable legal or constitutional argument. She added, and I note that this is the argument that she had second rather than first, it is absolutely not supported by the factual record, even if you do want to support it. She was talking to the judges. So the order of importance in her argument is that whatever ICE was doing, that's not a colorable or legal constitutional argument. And by the way, it's not true anyway.
Wow. So let's move on to kind of what happened next in this case. So he went before this immigration law judge, Wood, and I want to go to how this is typically ruled by immigration law judges, because as you pointed out, he certainly wasn't happy with some of the background that Rodriguez had with some questionable tax filings. But is it pretty typical for these judges to weigh, well, good moral character versus, well, bad stuff, for lack of a better way of putting it, against them and then decide whether they should be deported or not? Is that pretty typical for how these judges rule?
Yeah, I mean, that's in their rules of procedure for these cases. So, yeah, I mean, that is, you know, when that kind of a claim is made, that is what they regard. And, you know, those, in fact, in this particular case, for reasons that would be difficult for me to pull apart, those were the only two issues that were really on the docket, whether he had whether he had good moral character and, you know, essentially whether, you know, he had good standing with the law, that kind of thing.
Okay, so then from there, yeah, as you stated, it goes to the Board of Immigration Appeals, the BIA, and they overturned essentially Woods' ruling, correct, and said, oh, yeah, he needs to be deported, and that was kind of at the direction of William Barr's office as well, trying to push forward with that ruling. And then the Eighth Circuit of Appeal, or the Eighth Circuit here in Minnesota, also upheld their ruling. So that's kind of where it went to next. So is that correct?
It's correct. I mean, I don't know the degree to which Attorney General Barr personally was involved.
Right, yeah, not saying he was personally involved, but, yeah, his office was likely involved, correct?
Is that right? And you know, from everything I hear, this is kind of typical of the way this administration and this Eighth Circuit is dealing with these immigration cases. I mean, quite frankly, I see a lot of these go by, and there's somewhat routine just when I see them coming on the docket and I pay no attention to them. Really, the reason that this got my attention, and perhaps this is a bit classist, you know, classist on my part, I saw that this guy was a West St. Paul restaurant owner, and that, well, I went, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I started digging in. But, you know, we see routinely these immigration cases, and, you know, when I see the word affirmed in the, you know, in the capsule, the encapsulated description of it, I usually move on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why I was asking about this, because I wanted to know how common is this type of thing now to happen in the Eighth Circuit, because I know we have several judges that have been appointed by Trump and Republicans who are usually much more harsh on immigration rulings, and as you're talking about, he's probably not alone in having these types of rulings go against him.
I don't have any empirical evidence. All I know, all I have is anecdotal, input from various folks who I won't name, that that is the case.
Gotcha. Okay. So, as you said, he is already deported, but is there still any other legal proceedings that could take place with this case in the future?
Yes. I mean, they can, you know, Nielsen is considering some options, which could include an en banc ruling where they would pull together the full Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. And I've forgotten how many judges are on that. But these, like the Minnesota Court of Appeals, there are three judges on these panels. So these are heard and weighed by three judges of the Eighth Circuit. An en banc proceeding would involve all of the judges of the Eighth Circuit. But, you know, I'm not certain that Jason even feels that there's much more than a long shot there. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, I suppose the next move would be to file for a writ of certiorari with the U.S. Supreme Court.
And then
the U.S. Supreme Court, of course, hears very few of the cases that are submitted to it.
I believe, what is it, like less than 1% of the cases that are submitted,
it's
they actually
very, hear. Very small percentage.
Yeah, so the chances of that even working its way out of the Supreme Court, yeah, is probably pretty small. One final question regarding this case. So he, of course, did have family that was located in Minnesota. Do we know if they ended up going back to Mexico with him, or are they still in the state? Because you and I were also talking, it sounded like from some of these court hearings that it sounded like his family could be facing a lot of hardship with him now gone.
Boy, that is a giant question that partly because of the COVID crisis, I think I neglected to follow up on. I'm not sure where they're at.
Sure.
I know his 16-year-old daughter is a U.S. citizen, but I don't know if that means they've gone down there. I mean, his argument was that he wasn't willing to take his daughter, his 16-year-old daughter, to Mexico because he had no confidence that she would be able to receive proper medical treatment. So if I had to guess, I'd say they're probably still here and they're parted, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's certainly a very, very messy case. And later on, you should be having an article posted about this over at minlawyer.com, correct, where people can read up on
that's
this.
Right.
Excellent. Yeah. Okay.
And that the full name is Minnesota Lawyer, but minlawyer.com is the URL, and so it's a perfectly appropriate way to refer to us.
Yeah, I really encourage you to go and check out this article, too, because this is an extremely complicated case. It's not black and white, where, as we talked about, on the surface, he's not a squeaky clean person, but there are a lot of really complicating factors in this case. So I encourage you to go and read about this and check out the details, because there are lots of other cases that are probably similar to this one. All right, Kevin.
Well, and let me point out before we move on that his attorney argued that the allegations were untrue, you know?
Oh, sure.
And
yeah.
he only was convicted of a disorderly conduct charge. So when we say he wasn't squeaky clean, we don't know precisely how loudly he squeaked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's certainly a good point, too. And, yeah, even that initial hearing where he was accused of those allegations, well, even that was still kind of up in the air since, well, he wasn't even there himself. I mean, granted, he said his attorney was there, but, yeah, it's extremely complicated.
Right. I mean, lawyers normally, you know, they huddle with their client in court and say, well, you know, what they just said is not true, or whatever it might be. But the client plays a pretty major role in the trial. I mean, it's not just a passive, you know, observer.
And that was part one of my conversation with Kevin Featherly, the Capitol reporter from Minnesota Lawyer. Coming up in part two with Kevin, we'll talk about what could be happening at the state legislature as they are ready to reconvene.
AM950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Well, we're joined now by Kevin Featherly. He is the Capitol reporter for Min Lawyer, our usual Capitol insider, and also someone who covers a lot of legal cases working their way through the Minnesota courts, as he's going to update us on a couple of stories that he's been working on. Kevin, good to have you back on the show.
Nice to hear from you.
All right, Kevin, I want to cover a couple more topics with you. And, of course, you being the Capitol reporter, you follow closely what's going on in the legislature, which, of course, has been complicated with the coronavirus and COVID-19. Obviously, you probably haven't had a chance to go to the legislature very much since things have been in lockdown, but it sounds like the legislature is making some plans for what they might try to tackle when they get back or what they can even do remotely. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, let me back up to your earlier point. I mean, the legislature is not in session, that's true, but there's plenty of activity. You know, the Governor Walz having press conferences. Mm-hmm. I was at a judicial council hearing. They made special accommodations for me to listen to that on the third floor. I mean, I remain present at the Capitol and its environs, so that is still happening.
Oh, so you are physically at the Capitol occasionally, is what you're saying?
I will be there I'll be at the Schurstad room in the Stassen building, which is the revenue building, mm-hmm. in about 2.5 hours.
Oh, interesting. So they still are allowing media to go there. And let's get back to the legislature. So what exactly are they doing right now, even though they're not officially?
I think they're huddling together. They're discussing bills. You know, from what Speaker Hortman told us in our last press conference with her, at which the legislators very prominently displayed personal spacing, you know, social distancing. They demonstrated what it looks like for us. She told us that they're working 14 to 16 hour days. That this part of the session is for them personally, perhaps even busier than the session itself, which is already, frankly, a rather, you know, busy and frenzied place to be in normal times at this time of year. So, but I think what they're doing is they're working together on bills. We got a message from the Minnesota House, and of course it's the DFL leadership there, on some stuff that they have let us know, some things that they are now working on. And I think that's what you're talking about. What do you want to talk about? When they'll come back into session, I don't know. There was, I think, some indication that they might come back next week at some point. I think there was an aside between mm-hmm. Senator Gazelka and Senator Bach to that effect. But they may even come back sooner. They could be called back on very short notice. But at any rate, so what we're hearing now from the House, I haven't seen a similar announcement on the Senate side. But the House says, if you want me to go through these, I certainly will, bills that they are working on right now. One of them has to do with ensuring hourly workers and contract workers at schools so that they get paid. That's one. One is ensuring workers have paid time off for COVID-19 related illness or business closures. There's some measures on licensing extensions and flexibility for businesses because, you know, there are issues there, obviously. Preventing evictions and foreclosures during the pandemic, forgiveness for expired driver's licenses, giving the DHS commissioner temporary authority to keep long-term care and disability services up and running. And by the way, there was discussion in committee just before the shutdown, and I need to assess that more closely, but what I was picking up monitoring that debate is that it would give the DHS commissioner some pretty broad authority to do things that are not right now in her purview or powers. But I'd have to look more closely at that to see precisely what that is. But it has to do with keeping long-term care and disability services up and running. There's a child care provider support bill. There's local jobs and projects bill. That would be the bonding bill. And there's abatement for penalties for late income and property tax filing. So there's a lot mm-hmm. on the agenda that they're working on.
Yeah, certainly a lot on there. And one of the concerns that people might have, and it's kind of the world we live in right now with the coronavirus, is that, of course, well, it's tougher for the public to obviously go and be part of what's happening at the legislature since you generally can't go there in person. As you were talking about, they do have some other measures that you can take if you do want to be part of these and follow along what's happening, correct?
Yes, and they also laid out, you know, they're not closing it down entirely. I think they're going to, I'm not sure if they've banned, but they're certainly going to discourage. I think they may have banned. This is one of those many details that may have escaped my notice. There are many, I will assure you. They may have banned Capitol gatherings so that you can't just have these big demonstrations in the rotunda. But from the press conference that I referred to earlier, that was all four of the caucus leaders, and they laid out for us that they're will be the opportunity for the press to be in the committee rooms. but they'll limit access. So it's kind of, you know, I think it was four members of the press will be able to be in committee, and I think only five members of the public, maybe six, but it's limited. They're limiting access. And on the House floor, and I think on the Senate too, on the House floor, they were spacing people out to the extreme that they were emptying. Only half of the members can be on the House floor. Others were in the alcoves on the sides of the House, still on the House floor, but not at their desks, spaced out. Some were up in the galleries, and others were required to hang out in the caucus rooms. And if they want to vote, they're going to have to come up, gain access, go thumbs up or thumbs down. That'll be their vote on their way. If they want to take part in debate, they're going to have to replace a member who's on the floor, and that person will have to wipe down his desk with disinfectant, allow the other guy to come participate in the debate. That guy who came in to replace the first guy is going to have to wipe down, disinfect his space, leave. The other guy is going to come in and sit down at his seat. So incredibly convoluted, but, you know, these are the kinds of extremes you need to go to keep people safe.
Well, that is absolutely insane. But as you said, yeah, fortunately, the times we're living in right now. Hey, Kevin, we're going to have to leave it there as we are up against the clock, but really appreciate you joining me on the program today. Again, that's Kevin Featherly, the Capitol reporter for Minnesota Lawyer. Find his work over at minlawyer.com. Kevin, really appreciate the time.
Thank you.
As always, encourage you to follow Kevin Featherly's work for Minnesota Lawyer. The website is minlawyer.com, or you can follow him on Twitter. His handle is @KevinFeatherly. Coming up next, we'll talk with Aaron Clems from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, as we're going to wrap up a conversation we had yesterday talking about this recent court ruling regarding permitting and PolyMet. That's coming up next. Back for the final segment of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. So during this final segment, we're going to play back the entire interview I conducted with Aaron Clems of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, as we're going to talk about a couple of topics. One has to do with this recent court ruling that went against PolyMet and their air pollution permit, and then also why it's important to have a public transportation bailout. Now, as a heads up, you will have already heard the first few minutes of this conversation with Aaron, but I think it's still important to play back to get context for the rest of what we'll talk about, because there were lots of key points we weren't able to get to yesterday, again, being that it was such a busy news cycle. So just bear with this first few minutes, which are replayed for yesterday. But like I said, I think it's still important to kind of set the table for the rest of what we'll talk about. So without further ado, here's the interview with Aaron Clems.
Well, earlier this week, we received a rather significant ruling regarding PolyMet in the Minnesota Court of Appeals, where they remanded the PolyMet air pollution permit back to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, or MPCA, as the Court of Appeals found that the MPCA did not evaluate whether the air permit was a sham permit that does not accurately reflect the size and scope of PolyMet's proposed mine. So joining us now on the program to talk about that is Aaron Clems. He is with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy and their Director of Public Engagement. Aaron, thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Thanks, Brett. Glad to be here.
So can you talk about what exactly that ruling I just talked about means and what it does?
Well, this is the fourth permit that the Minnesota Court of Appeals has looked at that was issued to PolyMet back in 2018, and it's also the fourth one now that they've rejected. And the reason why they rejected this particular permit is what you said at the top, which was that they decided the MPCA didn't do their job. We brought evidence to the court, and we brought evidence to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency that PolyMet intends a significant expansion of the size of their mine and dramatic change in the way they would operate because of the low profitability of their current plan. And they refused to evaluate that. And the court held that they had to, and that they, because they did not, they sent it back to the agency to look at this question again. And this basically puts them back to square one. They have to take new evidence. They have to reopen a public comment period. They have to look at the real question, which is what is the size of the operation that PolyMet is really proposing, and whether or not the permit would actually protect Minnesotans' public health and the environment.
So lots of other permits, or I think there are a few other permits that are currently under appeal from PolyMet. Can you talk about those right now?
Sure. So in late January, early February, the Ramsey County District Court held a series of hearings where they put on the stand people like former MPCA Commissioner John Link Stein, other MPCA employees who worked on the PolyMet water permit, to get down to the question of what happened with the EPA critical comments about the water pollution permit. And that was an ongoing trial. It went for about 8 days. And right now they're in the process of filing what they call post-trial briefs, where they're submitting more evidence and legal argument to the court. At some point this summer, the district court will rule on that and then issue an order and send it back to the appeals court. So, and then we may see a change in what evidence is allowed for us to introduce. Because right now, the EPA's critical comments saying that the water pollution permit didn't protect Minnesotans' water and health were excluded from the public record, and the public never had a chance to see them. So we're hopeful that that change will result in the court, again, probably taking a harder look and maybe rejecting that permit as well. But that won't happen until later in 2020. One other case that's important is that, and this is a relatively recently filed case challenging the wetlands destruction permit. PolyMet would destroy over 900 acres of wetlands directly and potentially drain thousands more. Because when you dig a big hole in the ground, it fills with water, and that water comes from surrounding wetlands. And that was filed on behalf of MCEA and other organizations by a national group named Earth Justice in federal court. And there have been a few hearings in that case, but it's still very early in the proceedings for that one. So there are still multiple challenges to other permits still out there. And, of course, PolyMet has appealed to the Supreme Court over the case that we won earlier this year regarding their permit to mine and dam permits. And we're still awaiting word from the Supreme Court whether they will take that case.
And going back to this recent ruling from the Court of Appeals with their air pollution permit, what's PolyMet's response been so far from having this ruling go against them?
I mean, their public response is basically that they thought that the MPCA did their job and that they were disappointed in the ruling. But beyond that, there hasn't been much specifics. Of course, both the MPCA and PolyMet have the right to ask the Supreme Court to review this decision. They would have 30 days from the time of the decision, so sometime late next month before they would have to file a petition with the Supreme Court for review of that decision. And we don't know whether they will or not.
And going back to some previous conversations we've had with some of these PolyMet permits, a concern that a lot of people have is the fact that, well, it sounds like on most, if not all of these permits, we still don't have PolyMet's parent company, Glencore, listed on these permits, correct? Is that still the case?
That's still the case. And, you know, we heard things in fall of 2019 that we were really pleased with, that the Walz administration was taking this very seriously, that they wanted to make sure that Glencore was added to the permits. But subsequently, we haven't seen any action to require them to be on the permit. And this is important because Glencore's stake in the project only continues to grow. Just last week, they announced that they were lending another $30 million to PolyMet, their subsidiary. And in exchange, they would take a greater stake in the company. So their share of the company is only going up, and it will be about 75% of the stock that's outstanding. And so the idea that this is something independent of Glencore itself is a farce. Obviously, if you own 3/4 of the stock, you control the company. And we're kind of flabbergasted that they haven't been added to the permits as well.
And just to refresh everyone's memory on Glencore, they're a foreign corporation, multinational corporation, and they certainly have a very checkered history when it comes to labor rights, the environment, and lots of other issues, correct?
Yeah, no, there's additional legal developments there as well. So about 3 or 4 months ago, a group of plaintiffs and lawyers representing those plaintiffs from the Democratic Republic of Congo filed a lawsuit against Apple and a number of other electronics companies for the damage done to their clients from child labor, and they also listed Glencore as the source of these metals. And so, you know, the fact is that you've got a company that is an international bad actor that's been sued by a number of people or named in a number of lawsuits, and we don't think this is a company that we should be inviting into our state.
So what's going to happen next in the legal process in terms of this air pollution permit? As you said, there's lots of other cases that are working their way through the courts, but this thing is expected to go, at least for the air pollution permit, to the Supreme Court, correct? Or haven't we gotten any word yet on what PolyMet's plan is?
We won't know about the Supreme Court until sometime probably a few months from now. I mean, and of course, as everyone knows, things are really up in the air right now for everything. And so even the courts have been affected by this. And we expect that some of the processes that you might have otherwise seen proceed according to deadlines might start to get delayed. But if they follow the plan that they usually have, the plaintiffs or the folks who want to appeal the decision have 30 days to file their petition with the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court doesn't have any timeline or rule when they have to respond to that. They usually take a few months. And it might take longer, of course, given the current circumstances. If they don't take the case, then it'll be up to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to decide how to implement the decision.
Sure,
our reading of it suggests that they would have to reopen a public process. They'd have to take this evidence that we presented that showed that PolyMet's telling their investors that they want to propose a mine that's four times the size of what's been evaluated already, and account for that and decide whether the pollution permits that they've issued, and particularly the air pollution permit, actually does protect Minnesotans' air and health.
Wait, so go back to that. It's four times the size of what was originally planned on the permit?
Yeah, this is the fundamental factual issue in this case. Is PolyMet has proposed a mine that they would process about 32,000 tons of ore per day. But the plant that they would use has the capacity to process four times that amount. And throughout this process, they've told Minnesotans that they're proposing just this one mine of relatively small size, but they've told their investors through a number of securities disclosures in Canada that they would want to process up to 118,000 tons per day of ore. Now, these numbers might sound like they're kind of irrelevant, but these are totally different proposals. Under the larger proposal, they would build an 8-mile-long conveyor belt to move ore from the ore pit to the crushing operation. They would crush four times as much ore, releasing a lot more air pollutants, and for that matter, a lot more tailings would be left behind as well. That's the mine waste that's left behind after you crush and process the ore. And so they're kind of wink and nod at Minnesotans and tell them that they're proposing one kind of a mine, and then they tell their investors that they're actually proposing something totally different. Our argument to the regulators was you should evaluate what they're telling their investors. And the court upheld that and said that was something that the MPCA should have done, and that's why they lost the case.
Yeah, that would certainly seem logical to me as well. So, yeah, glad you brought up that piece of information because, yeah, that certainly is a very, very key. Hey, Aaron, I want to talk about one other topic that you guys are talking about over at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and this the idea of having a possible public transportation bailout amid the COVID-19 outbreak. Can you talk about what you guys are proposing and what you would like to see?
Yeah, so we actually have good news on that front. According to initial press reports coming out this morning, the bailout package, or I'm sorry, the COVID-19 relief package includes $25 billion for public transit. And this is really critically needed. These are really, I mean, when you hear the word bailout, you oftentimes think about a corporation or a business that is failing and needs public support. These aren't really businesses. I mean, these are public, essential public services for people, and they're all very much in strain right now because of the massive decline in the amount of folks using mass transit in response to all of what's going on with the COVID-19 outbreak. Just here in Minnesota, just today, Metro Transit announced that they were cutting back their schedule by about 40% and eliminating all overnight services because of a lack of ridership. And, of course, this is really this is a hit to their bottom line as well because they rely on fares in part for providing the support that they need. So we were happy to join with Transportation for America, which is a national group advocating for mass transit, as well as a couple of other advocacy groups here in Minnesota, Fresh Energy, East Metro Strong, and Move Minnesota, in advocating for this money. And we're glad to see that it was included as part of the COVID-19 relief package that's supposed to be voted on today and tomorrow.
Yeah, that's certainly some good news on the federal level, since, as you talked about, a lot of these whether it's a train or a bus, yeah, they're not going to be getting any fares and collecting any revenue, and they're going to be operating at a big, big loss. So some good news at the federal level. Have we heard anything on the state level from the legislature in terms of trying to help out with some of our public transportation systems?
Not yet, unfortunately. I mean, I think it's very understandable that the focus so far at the legislature has been on healthcare and making sure that people have access to healthcare. So the relief package that was passed last week was very much focused on hospitals. They're coming back into session tomorrow, from what we understand, to discuss an additional package of $400 million, but again, very much focused on human services and healthcare. But certainly as we go into the rest of the session, there will be a need to address other critical sectors of public services that are provided to people, and transit needs to be one of them. We're hopeful that will be included in whatever happens later in the session, but also, you know, there's a bonding bill that will still be considered, and that legislative leaders have said that they're going to still prioritize getting done this session, and we hope that there will be some support for transit in there as well.
Yeah, we'll have to follow along with that. We've been speaking with Aaron Klemms. He is the Director of Public Engagement for the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. They are located at mncenter.org. You can also follow Aaron on Twitter at Aaron Klemms, or the MCEA on Twitter. Their handle is at MCEA1974. Hey, Aaron, thanks so much for joining us today.
I appreciate it, Brett. Have a great day.
And a final note to cap things off with Aaron. We actually just did get word today that the Minnesota Supreme Court announced that they will be taking a review of a January decision by the Minnesota Court of Appeals that struck down three permits issued by PolyMet by the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. So all of these cases with PolyMet continue to work their way through the courts. And then to close off the show today, want to remind you that even though we are going to have that stay-at-home order go into effect tomorrow night, you can still get takeout from many of our great Eat Local Minnesota restaurants. We've mentioned how many times a lot of our Eat Local restaurants are going to get hit hard by the coronavirus closures, but you can still get takeout at a lot of our great restaurants, including Nightingale, Cafe Latte, Hazel's Northeast, the Great Wall Restaurant, and the Park Tavern. You can find a list of all of our restaurants at am950radio.com or eatlocalminnesota.com. Either way, please do make sure you support our Eat Local Minnesota restaurants and our other advertisers just in general, since they are going to be hit hard by what's happening. And the more you can support our advertisers, the more you help AM950. I'm back with a live show tomorrow, so I will talk to you then.